From the Sky News Centre at 5, police are treating an explosion near a mosque in Tipton in the West Midlands as a terrorist incident. Several nearby streets have been sealed off. Our reporter Adele Robinson is there.
As yet, there's been no injuries reported, but residents here have said that they've seen debris and nails on the ground. It's near to a mosque where this loud bang was reported. We know that now that West Midlands Terrorism Unit is investigating the possibility that this is a nail bomb.
In other news, as the funeral of Lee Rigby was taking place in Bury earlier, near the scene where he was murdered, the last post was sounded at his Woolwich barracks. During the service itself, family friend Sean Shear said he'd be deeply missed.
Lee's time on this earth was tragically cut short. But the love he had for his wife, Becky, his son, Jack, his parents, Lynn and Ian, and his sisters, Sarah, Chelsea, Courtney and Amy, will never fade.
Mourners clapped the family, and his two-year-old son wore a T-shirt saying, "My daddy, my hero." Campaigners are disappointed in the Health Secretary's decision to postpone the introduction of plain packaging on cigarettes in England. Jeremy Hunt says the government wants to see how a similar system in Australia works out before deciding whether to go ahead. The government's not going to hold a public inquiry into the death of the Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko. The 43-year-old died after drinking tea laced with radioactive polonium in London. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Deputy Leader of the Lib Dem Group, Councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Syrian government army is retaking some of the final strongholds, such as Aleppo and Homs, of the Syrian rebels, who are now, it seems, falling out amongst themselves. Nevertheless, the Foreign Office seems to be doing everything it can to justify sending arms to them. Martin Summers, he doesn't know it yet, but he will be going head-to-head with former Foreign Secretary and Chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, tonight. Plus, the prohibition of drugs in Britain is arguably doing more than anything else to support organised crime. We've invited Avon and Somerset's drug policy lead, Chief Inspector Paul Brunt, in to discuss drugs, but he's out of the force area, we're told, by the Portishead Police Press Office. We'll keep trying, though, and meanwhile, we talk to Chris Bovey this evening from anti-prohibition campaign Normal, who's driven up all the way from Totnes. Plus, Martin Summers will take us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. I imagine one of those hotspots is here in Bristol, as it's rather warm. Our news review we'll be looking at in a minute, but first, the two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, hot, no rain, and more hot. Lows of 13 degrees Celsius tonight, dry, highs of 27 over the weekend, sunny, highs of 26 next week, sunny but getting slightly cooler as the week progresses. Next weekend, the 20th and 21st of July, highs of 23, mostly sunny, both this and next weekend, but really hot this one. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Deputy Leader of the Lib Dem Group on Bristol City Council and Councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. Hi, Christian.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to Drive Time. First of all, you are a filmmaker as well as being a councillor. How do you have time to do it all properly?
Well, actually, I don't have time. That's the problem. I'm trying to write about three scripts at the moment, and it's really being interrupted by all the political work. But I haven't made a film for 18 months, but next one starts filming in October, so, yeah.
But you were saying just before we came on the air here that you've got a screening at the Watershed this weekend.
Yep, Sunday, 3 o'clock, a film called Cal. It's all based in and around Bristol, a young man.
C-A-L.
C-A-L, yep. A young man returning to Bristol to discover that it's sort of under siege to rioters and youth unemployment and the Occupy movement, and we've got footage and fed in the reality of real events as they unfolded.
So what is it, a docudrama or what?
It's a drama. It's a drama. It's a narrative drama. It's a love story, actually, essentially, at its heart.
Okay, and so how long is it? Is it a feature film?
Yeah, feature film, 90 minutes, yeah.
And are you managing to get that screened in other parts of the country or just here?
No, it's been screening in London and other parts of the country. This will be its last outing, I think, before it comes out on DVD in September.
Now, okay, as a filmmaker, obviously you're interested in the political angle, but how do you manage to to juggle what you're doing, trying to do with your films? With, I mean, you know, obviously, if you're dealing with things like riots, that can be a bit awkward, can't it?
It can be. There's but I wear two different hats. You know, there's the political hat, and then there's the passionate filmmaking hat. And the filmmaking hat tends to be a lot more politically left wing than my political hat wearing persona.
So, how do you get on with the police?
I get on fine with the police, other than when they're raiding my house.
And so, when did they raid your house?
The night before we started filming, actually, on Cal, they raided my house.
So, when was that? What year? And
that was December last year.
And why did they raid you? What was the reason?
They had been misinformed, that we had been stockpiling Molotov cocktails and guns in the back garden. But they were all props.
Okay. And what about film footage? Because obviously, as a filmmaker, you're using real film footage from possibly from riots as part of your film. Now, the police may wish to go on a fishing operation, mightn't they, and actually abuse their power, come and take those footage in order to try and identify suspects. Now, where does the law stand on all that?
Well, I'm sure that they would like to try and take some of the footage, and in fact we gave assurances to the people that we purchased the footage from that there would be no identification available to anybody of the people in the footage. And in fact we've used the modern technology of visual effects programming to put my face and other crew members' faces on some of the people in that footage.
Okay, but the thing is, if someone's handed over some footage for you to use, the police then come and raid you, surely the police can see what the raw footage is like. You can give all the guarantees you want to people who are handing footage to you, but maybe the police are going to get that.
Yeah, but now we've done the visual effects, the raw footage original has been long since lost and deleted.
Good. Okay. All right, Christian. What about your initial moves towards politics? Why the Lib Dem Party?
I was always a liberal when I was at school. In fact, I fought for a liberal candidate when I was 18, and much to the mirth and merriment of my fellow sixth formers who were all conservatives.
Well, why that? Why then? Even at that age?
Actually, it'd been my father that got me into politics, because as a Tory, he'd supported the war in the Falklands, and I was vehemently opposed to it. And as a 13-year-old, I had many a standing row with him, and actually at that point threatened to join the Labour Party just to annoy him. But that progressed to the Liberal Party, and then SDP it was then. And then from there I went back to the Labour Party, and then from the Labour Party to the Liberal Democrats.
So what was the problem with the Falklands? I'm not really necessarily asking you to justify your position as a teenager, but why did you decide it was worth taking a stand against your father to say, well, actually, no, this is wrong?
I couldn't justify the loss of life or the cost at the age of 13.
Okay, now you are now deputy leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, a bit of a rising star, I suppose you could say. You've only been a councillor a little while. What does it involve, that role?
I support the leader, Tim Kent, and together we will work on policy that the party is developing for Bristol City, and I will act as a liaison between all our councillors. And the group and the leader, in a supportive and guiding role. I mean, it's yes, you could say it's a bit of a leap, but I don't know. It's just happened and come about as a consequence of, I think, working hard and earning the respect of my colleagues, and I am very grateful to the position that they've elevated me to.
How's it all working out with the mayor? Because you've got a very strange situation going on in the city where no one's entirely sure what all these councillors are for. We're electing them, and obviously the mayor, George Ferguson, is listening to a certain extent, but he doesn't have to. How's that all working out? Who's really in charge?
Well, that's not necessarily true. He has no more powers than the previous leaders of the council had. So he has to still listen to councillors, because we bring to him all the problems that are inherent and exist within our wards. So we still have a function to perform. We also have a function on all the scrutiny and oversight committees that we are involved in, planning, in resources, etc., etc., all of which are now scrutinising and considering the policies and the plans that the mayor has put forward and wishes to implement. such as the residence parking, but let's please not go back over that, because I'm sure everyone's bored to death of it.
Well, some are, some aren't. You know, certainly people who can't afford to and are being, it looks like, being told you're going to have to pay now to park outside your own home. But anyway, we've got something that's been in the news this week that you've been involved in, I know, and that's something called the City Deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it sounds to me a little spiv-like, actually. Here, come on, shake my hand and let's sign the City Deal. What is the City Deal?
Well, certainly not signed in smoky back rooms. The City Deal brings together the four unitary authorities, including Bristol, under one opportunity to go forward.
So that's South Gloucestershire, Bath, North East Somerset, is it?
Yeah, and Bristol.
That's three?
That's three. What's the fourth one? North East Somerset, Gloucester, Baines, North Somerset,
North
South
Somerset
Gloucester
as well, okay. Yep. And under one heading. So this is like the old Avon area, roughly, is it?
Yes, but it's all predicated on the uplift in growth and the business rates. So collectively, the pooling of those business rates will be spent for the benefit of all of those unitary authorities.
So they all.
But it also, what it provides for is, as we move forward, we can borrow money against those projections and start to invest on capital programmes that all of the surrounding unitary authorities will benefit from. So the arena, so the, you know, the transport plans that we've got, the enterprise zone, and so on and so forth.
So these are mostly the. Why do you need to borrow money to have an enterprise zone?
Well, it's based on the revenues coming forward from the growth projections on business rates. Obviously, we can't wait 10, 15 years until all that money's come in and we just let it sit in a pot until we can spend it. We need to start spending it now to get employment, to get the economy going, and to promote growth here in Bristol and the surrounding regions.
And so who's going to be managing that then?
The local enterprise partnership, the LEP.
And they are?
They are made up of the leaders of the four unitary authorities, which would include George, some of the executive members, and then businessmen who have been nominated and posted, if that's the correct word, to that board.
Businessmen spending public money, is that a good idea?
Well, business leaders along with the leaders of the authorities. So, I mean, it's not as if they're being handed the cash to spend. It will be a group of people who will be making the decisions on our behalf.
Now, we had James Jury on here a few months ago talking about, because he's on the local enterprise partnership. One of the things about that is that those meetings are private meetings, that they're not actually open to public scrutiny.
Is that what he said?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. You can't, as a member of the public, I mean, if you want to go along to a council committee meeting or whatever, you can do that as a member of the public. With local enterprise partnership, you can't. It's a private company.
I'm unaware of that.
The other thing about the City Deal was is one of the things that they're also doing, which I know you do know about, is the management of public property. Now, again, you know, that this is it wise to be managing public property? Bristol's got, apparently, I mean, I don't know where it all is, but we've got more land in Bristol as a proportion than any other local authority in the country. So much of Bristol is actually owned by the City Council. That, as part of this City Deal, is going to be managed by this LEP again, the Local Enterprise Partnership. Well, what makes you think, I mean, there's a lot of faith being put in this, and also less scrutiny allowed by members of the public as to what's going on. So, you know, what makes you think this LEP is going to deliver where the council hasn't been able to?
Well, I think it is. I put it to someone the other day that the situation that we're in is that previously, you know, government had been very restrictive in some of the funding that we were receiving. In this particular instance, we are in a position where, very much like first-time homeowners, if you like, we're taking on the responsibility of taking out a mortgage with which we can then fund the growth and this infrastructure and enterprise here in the city, which then results in the fact that everybody in the city is responsible for making sure that it works, that we get working, that we start building growth and bringing jobs to this city, so that we can start paying back and the mortgage that we've taken on. With regards to the property aspect of it, you know, I think in some aspects it's good that we have finally sat down and done an audit of what property we do own, because from my experience in the past, nobody seemed to have a handle on exactly what there was available to us. However, I think it's important to understand that the board that will be controlling that property will be doing it on behalf of all of the services that we have responsibility for and responsibility to. So, for example, if the police or a school or the NHS or some service required some property, we can go to the resources that we've got, to the portfolio of property, and determine what is suitable for them without having to go through a huge bureaucratic process trying to identify and find something for them.
But the reason there's a bureaucratic process, surely, is because actually this is public money and we need to make sure it's being spent in the right way. I mean, if you've got a businessman sitting on that board, isn't he rather likely to push and go for and approve the sorts of projects which are going to help his business friends?
No, I think there are checks and balances in there to ensure that that doesn't happen. They can't sell off this property. It has to be used for the greater good. It can't just be sold willy-nilly for profit.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, before we talk about some economic blips there have been this week, what are your thoughts about this? It seems like quite a big shift, doesn't it, going on with this city deal between the council and elected people and council officers managing things to this local enterprise partnership. And we're moving into a sort of slightly dark area where the public and the press are not going to be able to scrutinise as well what's going on.
Well, I mean, the coalition abolished regional development agencies and they've created LEPs. And it's, to my mind, that's rather like moving deck chairs around. It may be that this is better than regional development agencies. We'll have to see. But there's always going to be a question about accountability when public money is involved. And, you know, we've had problems with private sector involvement in all sorts of public exercises over the last 30 years. Let's hope people have learned the lessons, but I'm dubious.
Okay, what about the another blip on the stock market this week? Tell us about that.
It hasn't been a blip. I mean, what's happened is that what happened a couple of weeks ago, when Ben Bernanke suggested he was going to taper quantitative easing, there was a warning heart attack, one of those heart attacks which don't kill you but tell you to change your lifestyle. And of course, instead of changing their lifestyle, they just said, "All right, well, we're not in fact going to stop quantitative easing. We'll carry on quantitative easing as long as possible." The Japanese have committed to quantitative easing, as you know, wall to wall, but in actual fact they're finding that it's quite difficult to sell their debt now. And I think we're reaching the point where the central banks have lost control of the bubble, and at some point some shock, maybe a war in the Middle East, will pop it. And then of course local enterprise partnerships in Bristol will be like rowing boats in the mid-Atlantic.
Christian, your thoughts on some of this macroeconomic stuff. Do you think that the central government's got it right?
To be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, you're a much better and more qualified economist than I am. My personal thoughts are, I find it very difficult to follow the money because so much of it is lacking in transparency in terms of where it's coming from and going to, because of the fact it's all sort of online and out there in the digital universe. So there's no paper trail on it. It seems to be just figures.
I suppose one very fundamental question is, do you think that the Treasury has got enough of a handle on controlling what's going on with money? Because it seems that the city seems to have the whip hand.
I don't disagree with that analysis. It does certainly perceptually look as if the city's got the whip hand. But then again, for me, curiously and personally, as just an opinion, I don't really understand it. Suddenly we seem to be able to materialise on virtual paper lots and lots of money, and it seems to be going from one place to another, but without us actually fully understanding how or why, and that's why I find it incredibly difficult to follow. All I'm concerned about, as I am for myself and other people, is, you know, how much am I bringing in, how much is our costs rising, and how much have I got at the end of the month.
Martin, where is this all heading? I mean, when I said talking about the stock exchange, it actually looks it's quite a good week this week, just looking at the Financial Times.
Yeah, well, the real problem is that stock market values are way out of line with what's happening in the real economy, and what happens in the stock market has virtually got no relationship to the real economy. So in actual fact, bad news is good news now for the stock market, because if there's bad news and the economy looks weak, that means they won't stop quantitative easing, that means the market goes up. And conversely, if the economy seems to be improving and they suggest that they might cut back on quantitative easing, the market goes, oh no, and goes down. So you can see how perverse the outcome is here. And we've locked ourselves into a, you know, what is basically a no-win situation.
Well, it does feel like the city is putting a gun to the government's head to just keep printing this virtual money.
Yes. And I think the problem is, you see, that mainstream politicians, including the Labour Party leadership, don't want to tell people the truth, which is in fact that this situation is probably way out of control and is going to require very, very radical action to deal with. But nobody wants to hear that, and because nobody wants to hear it, nobody wants to tell it them. And nobody's going to get elected by telling it to them, because people don't want to hear it. They go la 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 and put their fingers in their ears. And even if you were brave and came out and said, look, this is really a terrible mess and we're going to have to change a lot of things, most people would say, oh, no, because we're used to living in a capitalist society that just functions.
Yeah, but we mustn't forget, you know, well, certainly that the stock market just seems to me to be just one permanent game of roulette. Mm-hmm. It's a gamble. Everything's a gamble. And so the banks have bought into this, and unfortunately, the government has had to buy in by cash flowing all this gambling, and we're going to ultimately be the ones that end up paying for it, I think. I think you're absolutely right.
Well, one of the effects of all of this, if I try and look at that, was a fascinating headline in yesterday's Daily Mirror. The poor officially pay higher tax rates than the rich, as we're all in this together mantra is exposed as a lie. Official figures show that the least well-off households have been coughing up 36.6% of their income to the Treasury, but the wealthiest have been paying 35.5%. The Office for National Statistics, which released the report, partly blamed a tax scandal on millionaire George Osborne's controversial decision to raise VAT to 20% in January 2011. The duty on everyday goods such as food and fuel clobbers hard-up families more than the wealthy, because tax is paid at the same rate no matter how much people earn. Now this seems to starting to get into the realms of really, really quite a nasty, almost perverse, where the poor are being made to pay more as a proportion of their income, Christian, than the rich.
It certainly looks like that, doesn't it? I mean, I was surprised as anybody when he put VAT up to 20%, because actually I applauded Gordon Brown when he put it down, because it seemed to actually solve a lot of ills at that particular moment in time. I don't buy the argument that by putting it up it's more equitable and everybody has to gets to pay their fair share, because quite clearly from these figures that's not true. I think also this has been a political football that's gone backwards and forwards for years, as long as I can remember, the divide between the rich and the poor, and it seems to have got ever more distant the older I get, and certainly under Labour it didn't improve. In fact, wasn't it Tony Blair that turned around and said, I've got no interest in making David Peckham pay more tax? I mean, it persists, and right here and now the figures here seem to demonstrate that the poor are paying disproportionately more.
So what's Nick Clegg doing about it? Why isn't he twisting the arm of George Osborne?
Well, he's tried, hasn't he? We've been talking about trying to introduce a mansion tax to make the wealthier pay more for the properties that they own. We've introduced the £10,000 threshold in tax.
Maybe he's got some sort of metal arm that can't be twisted. Why?
Well, we managed to get it twisted, so we're almost there at the £10,000 tax-free threshold. So it's obviously working to some extent, but at the top end, at the other end, it's not. Don't forget, the Tories didn't give us what we wanted on the mansion tax.
Martin, once all taxes and benefits are taken into account, according to the ONS, top earners are left with £57,300 a year, while the bottom have just £15,800.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think some of this is ideological. There's a desire to make more inequality, although all the evidence suggests that more equal societies have much better social statistics, even for the wealthy, in terms of things like mental health and so on. The problem with the £10,000 tax, the £10,000 tax allowance, is that it interacts with Ian Duncan Smith's universal credit in such a way that the poorest don't benefit. And this is, left hand and right hand not understanding what right hand is doing. And I'm afraid that, that it's become unthinkable to talk about raising taxes, even for the Labour Party. And of course, in the 1950s, in the good old conservative 1950s, when we had Macmillan in this country and you had Eisenhower in the US, the top rate of tax was 96%. And that's because people were dying every day in Korea, not in Woolwich. And people realise that some people have to pay and other people have to die.
I don't necessarily agree with that analysis on the £10,000 tax threshold, because you only get that tax free, obviously, if you're earning. It shouldn't affect your credits until you've reached the £10,000 point.
The universal credit gets withdrawn before that point. So, in other words, Ian Duncan Smith has put his proposals forward, you've put your proposals forward, and the mix between the two is like mixing two drugs at a party. Yeah. And the result will still be... I mean, I think it's fairly clear, we can all agree on this, that the poor are getting a raw deal, one way or another. They're being given by far they just don't have the political power. The wealthy classes really do have the political power, and it's very difficult to budge them.
That's ever thus, I think.
I mean, it's always been like that.
Yeah.
Well, this came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, so let's go back to Wednesday to the House of Commons.
Pamela Nash.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. This morning I had a constituent contact my constituency office threatening to commit suicide because they were so depressed from the effect of welfare reform was having on them. I'd like to say this was a unique incident, Mr. Speaker, but it wasn't. Can the Prime Minister tell the House today what the Government is doing to analyse the effect of welfare reform on the mental health of this country and how he's going to react to it?
Well, as I've said many times at this dispatch box, I'm always happy to look at individual cases, but the fact is we badly need to have welfare reform in this country. The system was completely out of control. Housing benefit was out of control. DLA had gone up by a third over the last 10 years. We need reforms, and it's no good the Shadow Chancellor gesticulating. He now is in favour, apparently, of welfare reform. The only problem is that he opposed all 86 billion of the reforms that we've made.
Well, I mean, one of the problems from a Labour Party point of view is that they are moving onto the territory that the coalition has laid out in terms of welfare reform. We do need a welfare reform. We need a better welfare state, which gives people unconditional universal credits, which is what's being talked about on the European continent. For example, in Beppe Grillo's people in Italy, who took 35% in the recent general election, they're demanding €1,000 per citizen without any conditions at all. And then, of course, you can work on top of that. This kind of idea will come forward in the end. At the moment, we're still talking 19th century economics of poor and undeserving, deserving and undeserving poor.
This thing, Christian, of people wanting to commit suicide, phoning their MPs as a last resort, it's not good, is it?
No, it's a horrifying and pitiful situation, but I think it also rams home for all of us exactly how difficult the economic situation is and how actually perhaps we all need to be looking at how we can share the burden a little bit better and more equitably amongst ourselves.
Okay, so how can we?
Certainly, I don't know. We've got to balance the books, haven't we? We've got to balance the books, and unfortunately, in the long run, but certainly within the process of balancing the books, there are unfortunately going to be victims and people that lose out along the way. You know, welfare reform, yes, is one, but one area in which they're trying to fix the problem and claw back and try and make, you know, it always makes me laugh about when the Conservatives talk about making work pay. You know, what else would you be getting paid for if you weren't working? You know, it's a strange thing that they say. I don't quite understand it. But we've got to sort it out.
Surely there's something much bigger than these little things about, oh, well, we've got to make, you know, balance the books, because we're in such a massive amount of national debt that all the time money is being slowly sucked out of the real economy. And there's going to be no end in sight to this. If you look at the actual figures for the deficit, how much more we're paying in debt repayments than we're actually able to spend out there. There is no end in sight for this, and so we're going to get is more people surely saying, you know, that they are phoning up their MPs in desperation.
Yeah, they're horrifying incidences when that happened. But I mean, I think we must also look at the fact that there is a more positive attitude that's being introduced into the economy. We are seeing in certain areas things picking up. Which can only be a good thing. For a start, the sun is shining. We should be rejoicing at that.
Okay, the sun is free still. Martin?
I think part of the problem is the unfairness of the sacrifices is very clear. I mean, the structural adjustment should have been for the bourgeoisie. They were the ones who messed up. They were the ones who should have paid the price. 100% in my view. The bottom 50% of the population didn't have to pay anything. But leaving that aside, it's becoming blindingly obvious, even to stupid people, that if you cut the benefits and wages of the people in the bottom half of the population, what you're actually doing is sawing the branch you're sitting off on. You're just sawing through it. And there is no way out down this road. And I'm afraid the most likely outcome is going to be a global crash initiated by some event somewhere, a Cyprus or an island or whatever it may be. And then on the other side of that, we will find a situation where a very small proportion of the world's population will hold all the assets and everybody else will have next to nothing. But of course, there's plenty of guns floating around.
Now, also Prime Minister's questions this week. There's the knotty issue of party funding is coming up in the next few weeks, and there's a lot going on politically. So Ed Miliband decided he was going to pick this as his topic to ask a question of David Cameron.
Mr. Speaker, as the government considers the issue of party funding reform, can the Prime Minister tell the House how much his party has received in donations from hedge funds?
I'm not surprised he's got this sudden interest in party funding. But let's be frank, every donation to the Conservative Party is fully set out and public. But let's be clear what this real scandal is about. It's about trade union fixing of political appointments to this House. That's what it's about. So when he gets to his feet, let's hope he addresses the 40 seats that Unite have fiddled. Let's hope he publishes the full Kirk report. Let's hope he tells they don't want to hear. The problem is they're paid to shout and they're doing nothing about it.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't think he wanted to answer the question, did he? So let's give him the answer. The Conservative Party has received £25 million from a hedge fund. Next question. In the budget, the Chancellor gave hedge funds a £145 million tax cut. Can the Prime Minister tell us, was it just a coincidence?
The top tax rate under this government is going to be higher than it ever was under his government. But let me tell him this important point. There is a big difference between donations to the Conservative Party and donations to the Labour Party. And the difference is this. Donations to the Labour Party buy votes at your conference, buy candidates and MPs in this House, and pay for the votes that gave him his job. They paid their money, they bought their votes, they put him in his place, and that hasn't changed a thing.
Well, I had to edit out quite a lot of interventions from the speaker from that because it was pretty hair-raising stuff. The other thing, of course, is that the big difference between the donations to the Labour Party and from individuals via the unions and to the Conservative Party directly from individuals is the amount. Martin, what did you make of Ed's performance there? Because he's, you know, clearly after all this thing to do with 40 seats, apparently Unite, the union have managed to get out of the Labour Party. This whole relationship between the way parties are funded is starting to come to the head, isn't it?
It is, and it was bound to in the end, because of course it's fundamental. I mean, in the US, the Supreme Court has ruled that any amount of money can be paid into political campaigns, and you don't have to identify who's paying it or where the money came from.
Oh dear!
And that is the black hole to which we are descending.
The super PACs.
I mean, it's really in Scandinavia. On the other hand, places like Denmark, all political parties since World War II have been funded by the state in proportion to their support in the electorate. And that means, in fact, that wealthy individuals, corporations and trade unions, they can spend their money, but they can't spend it on political campaigning. And of course, what happens in Germany, for example, the SPD is not funded by the DGB, the trade union movement. The SPD is funded by the government, or by the state, and the DGB's political funds, or the various funds they've got to use for strikes, for putting their message out to the general population and so on. I think we've got to clean it up, because clearly, I mean, look at all the problems we're getting with the City of London not being properly regulated. If they are playing for the politics, and that's fairly absolutely clear what's going on in the US, Obama's biggest donations came from Wall Street. It means that they basically then control the legislative agenda, and with the consequences that we see. So this has got to change. And if change comes in a positive way, then maybe there's some good will come out of all this mudslinging.
So, Christian Martin, Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, what's your thoughts about where this is all heading? The Liberal Democrats are minnows, really, compared in the amount of money they get in and the amount it costs to run the Lib Dems compared to the Conservative and the Labour parties. But what do you think would be an ideal situation? We're in a situation this week There's a lot of hoo-ha about MPs getting a pay rise, which seems perfectly reasonable. Everyone should get a pay rise. But you know, if there's people saying that MPs shouldn't, the idea that we would then be funding political parties as well, I mean, surely the public's going to be outraged at that.
Well, I'm sure the public would be, but I mean, I think the influence that has just been suggested could be bought if we keep going down this path of non-reform of party political funding.
But it's already being bought, isn't it?
Quite possibly, whatever, $25 million from hedge funds. I think that's a significant amount of money, and it demonstrates exactly how close these lobbying firms and large banking organisations are, and financial institutions are, to the Conservative Party. I mean, I've always thought that with each within each Conservative government that we've had, we've got closer and closer to the American model, be it with, you know, the creeping privatization of the NHS, or with you know, party political funding and the control by those with financial interests. I mean, it's a sticky wicket that we're on. I speak from a party that, you know, organically and I think possibly more honestly, in my opinion, you know, funds itself through its membership, through, you know, activists on the ground holding, you know, cheese and wine and politics and pizza evenings and raising money that way.
No six-figure checks for you guys. Ooh, I'm not sure about
that. I know you're alluding to the fact that we've had that in the past, but, you know.
Anyway, it wasn't the only question at Prime Minister's questions about party funding.
Alan Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Tory chair of the Treasury Select Committee has described the government's banking reforms as falling short, yeah, and in some respects virtually useless.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this the payoff for all the millions the banks have poured into the Tory coffers?
Is this government that commissioned the Vickers report? It's this government that committed to a ring fence around retail banks? It's this government that is legislating to have criminal sanctions against bankers? What did the last government do? What did those two? What did those two do when they were sitting in the Treasury? When Northern Rock were handing out 110% mortgages? They were knighting Fred Goodwin and watching while the Rome burnt.
Watching while the Rome burnt. Virtually useless, Martin, apparently, the government's banking reforms.
Well, I think Andy Tyrie, who's a Tory MP who's headed up the Banking Reform Committee, has actually done us a service. I mean, he's basically said that they've not taken my recommendations on board as a Tory. And we've had, as you know, Rowan Bosworth Davis on this show, who's ex-Met Fraud Squad officer, and he was saying, that the problem with having a law against reckless banking is we've already got laws against reckless banking, they're just not enforced. And I think that the real problem we've got now in Britain and the US in particular is the control of the fire, insurance and real estate sector of the political process, directly and indirectly. Nobody seems to be able to do anything to stop them. And I think nothing will be done until there is a crash. Only then will people see that they've got no clothes on.
Christian, what do you make of this term, virtually useless, to describe the government's banking reforms?
I think it's a curious expression. We've lent a lot of money to the banks, as I said right at the beginning. You know, it's curious that this money suddenly materialised from somewhere through a computer programme. I applaud Stephen Williams' suggestion that we should have all ended up getting shares in these banks that we've put money into and profited from the increased value of those banks as and when they pull themselves out of the debt.
Yeah, can I just say on that point, they're all bankrupt and they're not. You can't actually give away something that's worth less than what it says on the
maybe basis. That's why we haven't been offered these shares, because they're not really worth anything.
All the banks are bankrupt.
So are you suggesting that the government's going to be selling us when it does privatise or sell shares in these banks, that they're going to be selling us just hot air?
Well, they'll be selling them at a loss to the taxpayer, and it's mostly going to go to the city. But it's not even clear that they will be able to sell the banks, to be honest. That's part of the problem. So all the money we've given to the banks, we may have to just write off.
Well, I'd rather be holding stock in something that might be worth nothing at the moment if it were to then suddenly turn around and make a profit in the future.
Ultimately, what we need to do is think about what kind of a banking system we want in terms of supporting our industry, rather than, you know, who should own it. I think, you know, ultimately what we're probably looking at is probably a nationalisation, a proper nationalisation of the banking system.
Well, I'm afraid, bad news for you, Martin, because we won't be selling off the banks. What we will be selling off is Royal Mail. And here is another question. This is from the House of Commons this week. And we're here, Simon Hughes, Lib Dem MP, then Vince Cable, the Lib Dem Business Secretary, followed by the Labour beast of Bolsover, Dennis Skinner, discussing the privatisation of the Royal Mail.
I do not support a majority sale.
Well, I did make it very clear that the government plans to become a minority shareholder in this company, and the majority will be a combination of shares sold in the market and shares that will be held by employees.
What guarantees can he give as a little liberal just how we manage to keep this so-called share-owning democracy in this country?
Well, Dennis Skinner's final point was, is it okay to have a foreign country or foreign banks coming and buying up our post office? And I know it probably didn't come across very well, but what Simon Hughes was saying at the very start was, I do not support a majority sale, and that's because in the Lib Dem manifesto they did talk about the possibility of selling off the Royal Mail, but they said that the majority of the shares would be held by the state. Now, Christian, that's not happening, and it's actually the majority are going to be floated on the stock exchange and the minority are going to be held by the state. So why this U-turn from what you pledged in the manifesto originally back in 2010?
Well, I think it goes to the fact that we're in a coalition, and it's difficult to negotiate from your ideological manifesto into a coalition policy what it is that we wanted. At least we have secured for some of the workers, the workers in the post office, you know, a stake and shares in the company. I'm surprised that Vince Cable actually announced it. It does seem to me to be riddled as a bit of a conservative policy and idea, this.
That's probably why they made him announce it.
Yeah, so it's another credibility issue for us.
Vince is stepping up as a human shield for the Conservatives, isn't
it? We seem to have taken a lot of bullets lately.
But why? Why would he do that? I mean, it doesn't give the Liberal Democrats a lot of credibility when Vince, you know, seemed to be a bit of a shining star in the Lib Dem party, is the guy to take the rap for something like selling off the Royal Mail, which, you know, actually is making, we all own, is making a profit for us, and it is now being floated on the stock exchange. And Martin?
Well, I mean, we've had CWU people on this show in previous weeks.
Communication workers who represent a lot of post office.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that polls show that 80% plus of people do not want it privatised. They've just had a ballot of the members, the workers who work in the post office, and like 90% of them don't want it privatised. But it's going ahead anyway because the financial elite have written in their diary that it is to be done. You know, things to be done, privatise the post office. And if Labour were in power, they'd still be knocking at the door saying we've got to privatise it.
But isn't behind this...
Was going down that road before the coalition was
in power.
But
isn't behind this need almost to capitalise the Royal Mail and sell it off, or through a sell-off, the fact that the government's bailed out the pension fund.
Well, exactly.
And it's got to pay for that, and so therefore selling shares would assist us, that's all taxpayers, in paying for this deficit in the pension fund.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because of course if what happens is that the taxpayer has picked up the pension liabilities of the post office, which then makes it viable to sell. If a buyer had to take over those pension liabilities, they'd take one look at it and say, no, we're not doing it. And that, of course, is the rational policy, which is to keep it running as Royal Mail and don't sell it off. It's starting to make a profit. Why can't we just leave well alone? But we can't. And I'm not making a party political point here, because if the Labour Party were in power, the City of London would still be demanding their pound of flesh, and there are elements within the Labour Party who'd want to give it to them and say, we're the people who can deliver that. We will shut up the Communication Workers Union for you. That's how bad it's got, that nobody can question this kind of thinking, even though everybody realises that it's, you know, 20 years out of date.
It might also demonstrate the desperation of our actual economic situation and the need for us to have a bit of a fire sale to some extent of the post office, you know. We've got debts to pay. The pension fund is a debt, you know. We've got to plug that hole somehow.
Yeah, well, I mean, the macroeconomic decisions that have been taken have been poor. We were in a difficult situation, but the austerity policy both here and in Europe has demonstrably failed. And as we go forward, eventually we're going to hit a real turbulence, and at that point everything is going to come up for grabs. People are going to start asking, well, why are these people so wealthy? When in actual fact they haven't done anything, they've manipulated the system politically to bail themselves out. And there's no free market in there at all. It's socialism for the wealthy and devil take the hindmost for the poor.
Well, surely, I mean, you know, as everybody owns the Royal Mail at the moment, why aren't we getting compensation? This is robbery, Christian, by your Vince Cable.
Well, by the coalition government, of which Vince is one MP and a member of the cabinet, obviously. But, it always amazes me that nobody has gone after the Conservatives over all the other privatisations that they handled historically in the past. You know, public transport, water, gas, electric, you know.
Well, it's funny you say that, but actually Chris Grayling did do that this week over a certain company called G4S, who we've had on this programme, talked about anyway several times before, and Serco. And this is... Yes, the Justice Secretary Chris Grayling's statement on the overcharging by G4S and Serco.
There are a small number of cases where charging continued for a period when the subject was known to have died. In some instances, charging continued for a period of many months and indeed years after active monitoring had ceased. The House will share my view that this is a wholly indefensible and unacceptable state of affairs. I should state that I have no information to confirm that dishonesty has taken place on the part of either supplier. But given the nature of the findings of the audit work that has taken place so far, and the very clear legal advice that I have received, I am today asking the Serious Fraud Office to consider whether an investigation is appropriate into what happened at G4S, and to confirm to me whether any of the actions of anyone in that company represents more than a contractual breach. What we are now doing is launching formal proceedings internally, which are likely to include, or may well include, depending on the circumstances around the individuals, may well include disciplinary proceedings to establish precisely what did go wrong. Something clearly did go wrong. Enough knowledge came into the department to flag this issue some years ago, but it was not acted upon.
Not acted upon, Martin. Now, what's been going on here is Serco and G4S have both been charging us, the taxpayer, for people they've been supposedly looking after, including people who've been being tagged, for people who are dead and who don't exist.
Yeah, well, it's an abuse, isn't it? I mean, Chris Grayling is a Conservative minister, but there he is saying it's an abuse, and of course it is an abuse.
And there was a bit of a trembling in his voice. Well, I don't know if you heard that. He sounded quite nervous, didn't he, talking about the legal aspects of it.
The problem with a lot of privatisation of these kind of core functions of the state, which is kind of basically law and order, is that it's not really amenable to competitive market pressures. I mean, there's only, you know, G4S and Serco are the only people in this market. There's not hundreds of little security firms. And, of course, you can't have hundreds of little security firms, because how would you know who was reliable in those security firms? Do they have security clearance and so on? And that's why we invented a kind of national police force and all the rest of it back in the 19th century. And we've got to relearn all these lessons through all of these mistakes.
But why do we have to? Why have we still got a contract with these two people at the end of the week when we've discovered at the beginning of the week that they've actually been lying?
Well, they can't stop them doing their job overnight, because we'd have anarchy in the system, because there'd be no one to police it.
They've been allowed to get a hold, haven't
they? Exactly, they have been allowed to get a hold, but you know, so we can't do it that way around. But I mean this has echoes of when I was much younger under the last Conservative government, and G4S losing prisoners in vans. And at that point, why didn't the red flag go up? But, you know, it would be interesting to see whether or not, I don't know, I'm not going to cast aspersions or say anything libelous to suggest there might be a link between party political funding and these contracts. But, you know, it's very interesting that that he was trembling, and I think he was trembling because he probably knows a hell of a lot more than we do.
Yeah, and he's just been told maybe he can't say that in public yet. Anyway,
yeah.
G4S, it wasn't the only occasion G4S were in the news this week. It was also Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper. Oh, sorry, no. There was another occasion where somebody was killed by two members of G4S who were put onto he was put onto an aircraft while he was being deported, and actually it was also on the two G4S staff's phones. Racist texts were then afterwards found. Martin, it doesn't look good, does it? And also, it doesn't look good for the Crown Prosecution Service, because all the evidence was there for them. They had a look through the evidence and they said, oh, well, there's nothing to see here. We don't think there could be a prosecution for this. I mean, these two guys actually suffocated this guy and he died. I mean, surely that's murder.
Well, you could argue that's a manslaughter, certainly. I mean, the problem is that if once you start questioning things like G4S's contracts with the government or the bailing out of the banks, what you're actually saying is we're going to have to overturn the apple cart completely, because that's what we've been doing for the last 30 years, is outsourcing the key functions of the state. And ultimately, the problem with that is that it's massive. Look at the Pentagon's budget. You don't save money by contracting out military production. In actual fact, the way to save money would be to bring military production, for example, in-house, and you only spend money on it when you really need to, rather than, because of course, people, once G4S are there, they've got an interest in crime. They've got an interest that you know, it's like the private healthcare system in the US. I don't think I can't help you, but my brother can. So there's a constant desire to create more problems to be resolved once you've got the private sector involved, and it's just part of the way in which the private sector operates.
Can I just say something, Christian, quickly? This guy is Jimmy Mbenga, and he was died as the plane waited on the runway at Heathrow. He was restrained by three G4S officers, actually, Hughes, Trebelnik, and Colin Kaler, for about 35 minutes.
Yeah, no, it's another very upsetting and disappointing story. But, you know, I'm not wishing to defend G4S in any way, but, you know, we have heard similar stories like this with regards to policemen being overexertive in their restraint of prisoners in prison cells. So, I mean, it's these things happen. It's not that I'm in any way suggesting that this isn't outrageous, because it is. Somebody shouldn't have died. But how do you mitigate for the behaviour of people like this, be they police officers or private security firms? I'm not sure. You know, someone has to be held to account on this. And
I think the issue with police officers is they get a lot more training than your average G4S thug.
Which probably goes to the heart of the question: should these jobs be privatised out?
Quite so.
You know.
Yeah. So they actually said the guards who were there that he had actually forced his body into a position where his head was right down below the level of the chair, one that's known to carry the danger of asphyxiation. I mean, surely they do have a duty to actually make sure that the guy can breathe.
Well, yes, but I mean, the question is, are these just incompetent people who are doing this job? And obviously having racist comments on your phone doesn't sound very good. I mean, this is the problem. You see, a police officer with racist comments on their phone, that would be picked up. You shouldn't be a police officer, mate. You're in the wrong job. G4S, they smuggle in under the radar.
Absolutely.
Well, the inquest this week has found that he was unlawfully killed. So, Christian, what do you think should happen now?
Well, there clearly has to be now a further investigation into the role that these G4S employees had in that death. And if it leads to a prosecution, so be it. You know, it's quite clear that there are questions that need to be answered. And justice needs to be done for Jimmy.
I mean, it hasn't so far, has it? What I mean, why? I mean, all this information has come out during the inquest. I would imagine that the Crown Prosecution Service were appraised of all of this before they decided not to do any prosecutions.
I should think that actually one of the things that has thus far sort of resulted in this not moving forward is the fact that people are concerned about demonstrating how far and wide this creeping privatisation of our security services actually got. You know, but I'm sure more instances like this unfortunately will come out in the future until we sit down and tackle it.
I believe in the US, that US Homeland Security has got 1 million employees now.
Okay, now. Finally this week, the Public Accounts Committee, let's go down and have a listen to that, because it was a pretty interesting exchange. It was actually the Tory MP, Stephen Barclay, questioning David Nicholson and other top NHS managers at the Public Accounts Committee about what happens to people who have failed as NHS managers. Where do they go?
One of the other players at Morecambe was the Care Quality Commission, and obviously people are well aware of the failures. Indeed, this committee had a hearing last year where we criticised its poor leadership. That didn't stop glowing tributes being given to its outgoing chief executive by the Department of Health when she left. What I just find striking is that Martin Yates, the chief exec of Midstaffs, got a payoff and then goes to a charity, Impact Alcohol and Addiction Services, which is funded by the NHS. Cynthia Bauer leaves the Care Quality Commission with tributes and goes and works for Skills for Health on their board, which is funded by the government, by BIS. Tony Housel goes to the NHS Confederation, another charity, in this case one driving all its money from the NHS. Mike Farrer, the chief exec of the North West Strategic Health Authority, who people like Mr. Titcombe, whose son tragically died at Morecambe, is very critical of. He gets himself a £200,000 perk running another charity, the NHS Confederation. I don't know whether it's a sort of a retirement home for lame ducks and sitting ducks, but there just seems to be a trend. Bodies like the NHS Confederation are using public money to park people who have failed within the NHS, and the Treasury is signing off the deals as value for money when they leave. And I struggle really to see, I go back to your own guidelines. Departments should not treat special severance as a soft option.
Yes.
Are you satisfied that it is not being used as a soft option?
In the cases that we have signed off, we will have been satisfied by the judgment taken by the department. In this case, the NHS concerned, they are not using public funds instead of taking a proper and appropriate HR route of disciplinary action.
Could you tell me how many hospital bosses have had their compromise agreement turned down and have been dismissed with no payout?
I don't know, others may. I mean, there are certainly cases that we
I'm not talking where they've perhaps stolen something or there's a gross misconduct, something clear-cut. I'm saying overperformance.
I don't know the answer to that.
Do you know, Una? David?
No, I don't know the answer to that.
David?
So we're not aware of a single case, is what you're saying?
I'm not saying I'm not aware of a single case. What I am saying
Name the ones you are aware of, then.
I don't know the answer to
you name the ones you are aware of?
I will...
Is it Brian? If you're not saying you're not aware of a single case, which you just said, can you name the ones you are aware of?
There may be cases, I don't know. That's what you're saying.
You just said I'm not saying I'm not aware of any cases. The implication of that is that you are aware of some cases. Which ones?
I don't know the answer to the question.
What about Sir David?
No, I said I don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer. Well, actually, the logical conclusion from that little session at the Public Accounts Committee was that performance actually doesn't matter, Christian. If you perform very badly, you totally fail, that you can still get your lovely payoffs.
Yeah, it's a bit of a joke, isn't it?
Well, it isn't, is it? If you think about this, massive amounts of public money, sometimes hundreds of thousands of pounds going to these people as they fail in an important public post. I mean, they're not really civil servants at all, are they?
Well, this is not just in the NHS. Let's not forget we've had the same problem and issue that's reared its ugly head in the BBC this week.
That's true. Anyway, that's all we've got time for with Christian Martin. Next, it's drugs and also Malcolm Rifkin, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, with Martin Summers after the news.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.